Air America is proud to present a fact-based initiative. Mother Jones Radio. Great reporting, straight up. Here is your host, Angie Coiro.
In for Angie Coiro, I'm Peter Lawfer here with Mother Jones publisher Jay Harris. And as the devastation from Hurricane Katrina is assessed, the connection between this killer hurricane and the Iraq War is becoming clearer and clearer. Louisiana and Mississippi National Guard are in Iraq. Their equipment is in Iraq. And money budgeted to fix the levees that breached was diverted to Iraq to pay for the war.
We're talking now with Will Bunch. Will has recently done quick reprise of the coverage that has been about disaster preparedness in this part of the United States.
He is a senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News and is writing for Mother Jones Magazine.
So, Will, I'd like to ask you what you found in your research.
Well, I had heard on Monday, the day that the hurricane actually hit the Gulf Coast, I had read on the internet that there had been some budget cuts for flood and hurricane relief programs in New Orleans. Somebody had posted a story from last year about steep proposed budget cuts for some of these projects, including levee rebuilding. And actually, Tuesday morning, when the levees started to fail in New Orleans, I was curious, whether these particular levees had been targeted or affected by these budget cuts. And I decided to look through the whole history of the coverage. And what I found was that it was very clear and very explicit that right around the time that the government started trying to fund the war in Iraq and deal with the massive tax cut and what was going on in Afghanistan and Homeland Security and all these things at the same time, that money for levee work and other types of basic flood relief programs in New Orleans were slashed dramatically, roughly in half.
So what kinds of things have been reported by the New Orleans paper and elsewhere?
Well, the New Orleans paper, the Times-Picayune, which is a very good newspaper, and they had done a big series in 2002 about some of the hurricane dangers to New Orleans. So they gave a lot of coverage to how these programs progressed and were financed in the different communities. All of a sudden in 2004, officials from the Army Corps of Engineers started going to some of the communities around New Orleans and said, we know you need this project. And in one case, he said, we know the levees in your communities have subsided recently by about 4 feet. But frankly, we just don't have the money in our budget this year to do anything. And a couple of local communities, local parishes in the New Orleans area actually had to go into their own property tax money and raise some funds on their own for things that used to be mainly federally funded programs to try and shore up some of the levees because they'd run out of money. And the officials with the Corps of Engineers, like I said, were very clear that the reason for the funding crisis was the federal budget was so tight, and that was largely because of what was going on over in Iraq.
And Will Bunch, as you assessed this coverage, were you able to determine that it wasn't a surprise? It was well covered, and people in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast would know about this, as should the rest of us around the country?
Well, like many news stories, it was very well covered. In fact, I found 9 instances in the Times-Picayune where funding cuts for this flood relief program were mentioned in the context of priorities in the war in Iraq. And but like a lot of things, the story gets covered on the Metro page. People see it. It doesn't, among the general populace, I don't know how much this had really sunk in. But clearly among the people who were closest to this issue, they knew there were problems. They were very concerned, and they knew it was a matter of priorities. In fact, kind of the main quote that I uncovered when I was doing this research was the emergency management chief for Jefferson Parish, near New Orleans, said, quote, it appears the money has been moved in the president's budget to handle Homeland Security and the war in Iraq, and I suppose that's the price we pay. Nobody locally is happy that the levees can't be finished, and we're doing everything we can to make the case that this is a security issue for us.
a sobering quote you found. Senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, Will Bunch, thanks for joining us here today on Mother Jones Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Peter Laufer with Mother Jones publisher Jay Harris, and we're connected with reporter Mike Dunn from the daily newspaper The Advocate in Baton Rouge. Mike Dunn has been writing about levees in Louisiana since the 80s and weathered the storm there in Baton Rouge. And when we first talked, Mike, I said to you, you're lucky. You were far from the storm, and you tell me that's not true.
No, it didn't. We had 25 to 35 mile an hour winds with some higher gusts here, and actually we were predicted to have a few more, stronger winds here. The hurricane jogged about 13 miles to the east of the projected path as it came in, and that 13 miles sometimes makes the difference between a lot of damage and a lesser amount of damage. A lot of old oak trees here in town, and a lot of them came down because of the strong winds, damaged a lot of homes, took out about 300 power lines. And a large portion of Baton Rouge is still today without electricity.
So, Mike, our last guest quoted the emergency management chief for Jefferson Parish, telling the Times-Picayune that it appears that the money's been moved from the president's budget to handle the war in Iraq and homeland security issues and away from levees. Now, is that contributing to the problem that New Orleans faced?
Well, obviously there hadn't been enough money spent over time. The system is that was in place on Sunday evening, so to speak, is designed for a Category 3 storm. I know that the Corps requested a lot more money for the Southeast Louisiana project, as it's called, or SELA, and I think they didn't get what they were looking for. I don't know that it would have made a difference in this particular storm, but it certainly doesn't help.
So what are the other factors that contribute to the situation that we're seeing on the ground now?
Well, a lot of it is we've developed in probably places that we shouldn't have. In many cases, I grew up in New Orleans, and a large portion of the area that is flooded out in Jefferson Parish, I can remember truckloads of river silt being dumped out there so people could build houses on top of that in the 50s and 60s, and maybe even in the 70s when I was growing up. Since we've had wetland regulations, the Corps is generally pretty liberal about giving people permits to fill in wetlands and develop. And so a large portion of New Orleans, especially some of the places that are flooded, were originally swamped, so it doesn't take much to get them flooded, especially when you have a storm that pushes in storm tides of 18 to 20 feet.
Absolutely. Now, Mike, you said that it's hitting you personally, too, that you're about to bring your mother and your nephew in because what happened in New Orleans to the house?
Yeah, like I said, I'm originally from New Orleans, grew up down there, and my mother still lived on Canal Street, and she lived in a real rare sort of basement apartment. And right now I know that her apartment is absolutely filled with water, and everything she's got is gone, and my nephew probably is not, his house is not full, but by the time the water gets out, everything he's got is pretty well shot. And they've kind of come to accept it and move on, and that story is repeated, unfortunately, hundreds of thousands of times right now in New Orleans.
One quick question, really, on the human cost of this tragedy. You mentioned the hundreds of thousands of people displaced by this storm. What provisions are you seeing being made for these people?
Well, that's part of what everybody's wrestling with right now. Not probably three blocks from me, there's our convention centers being used to house people, many of whom are people who were yesterday and last night and today plucked from roofs, from their roofs, or somebody chopped a hole in their roof and in their attic and they climbed out. There have been a lot of those. And right now they're just kind of trying to wrestle with it. What do you do with all these people? Especially, they're not going to be able to go back home, for weeks, if not months. A lot of things are starting to coalesce. I heard about Baptist Church here, Florida Baptist Church, where they're planning to start feeding 16,000 meals a day. You know, that they've pledged to do that. So the whole recovery effort is really still in its infantile stage, and I'm not sure. I don't think we've ever looked at anything like this before. We hadn't really faced anything like this before. So,
well, we wish you the best of luck there. Mike Dunn, reporter for The Advocate, thanks for joining us here at Mother Jones Radio. I'm Peter Laufer with Jay Harris. Coming up, we travel to Iraq and talk with Louisiana National Guard stationed so far from home during this crisis. For further details about what we're covering this hour and to learn more about Mother Jones Magazine, visit the website MotherJones.com.
This is Mother Jones Radio, digging deep to bring you real news.
In for Angie Coiro, I'm Peter Laufer, here with Mother Jones publisher Jay Harris, and we're so pleased to welcome to the program Lainey Poche, Sergeant Lainey Poche, speaking to us from Iraq, a member of the Louisiana National Guard. Where are you serving in Iraq, Sergeant?
I am in Baghdad right now.
Lainey, this is Jay Harris. What's it been like for you and your unit to watch these heart-rending events from over there?
It was absolutely heartbreaking. We found out about it a couple of days before it happened, and we didn't realize how severe it would end up being, and it blew us all away.
Are you anxious to get back, Lainey? Is it frustrating to be there in Iraq when the kind of work you do is needed in Louisiana?
It's very frustrating, especially when we have skills that are needed out in the streets to help control the people, just to keep everything under control. And we're starting to filter back through. We should all be home within the next month. That's the good news.
So what do you want to do when you get back to Louisiana?
My civilian job?
Well, no, I was thinking with your unit. I mean, you'll still be serving in the Guard. Is that right?
Well, it's kind of up in the air right now. I don't really know if we'll be going on hurricane duty or not. So it really all depends.
But what would you like to do? What are your skills, Sergeant? What would make sense for you to be doing once you get back to Louisiana to help with the crisis there?
It would probably be the crowd control, just to control the people, you know, just to put a sense of stability back into the town. Because a lot of people are getting out of control. You know, they just need a hand that says, okay, this is what you're going to do, that's how it's going to be.
Did you join the Guard to serve your home state?
Yes, I did. Sure did. And I never expected to come to Iraq, but I'm very proud to be serving.
Sure, but again, it must be frustrating to be there in Baghdad and to watch these pictures of New Orleans. Where is your home in Louisiana?
I live in Lafayette, which wasn't really affected.
Right, right. And your colleagues in the Guard, what have you been doing in the off-duty times? Have you been just huddled around the television watching Louisiana?
I mean, we have hundreds of people who have completely lost homes, you know, some family members. What can you do? You know, you're in another world. You know, it breaks your heart because you wish these people could be at home to care for their loved ones. We're over here fighting a war.
And equipment too, Lainey. Do you have equipment, Louisiana National Guard equipment there in Iraq that could be helpful word in Louisiana?
Yes, we have bulletproof vests. We have Kevlar helmets. Yes, all bulletproof Iraq equipment.
Amphibious vehicles? Any other kind of heavy equipment that could be helpful for the recovery?
See, we're not taking back any vehicles. All of them are staying for the continuing units.
One thing that I've been curious about, and you might be able to also base this on some of the conversations you've had with your colleagues there, but do you see any conflict between the service in Iraq and the needs of your home state right now?
Yeah, I guess it's bound to happen. I mean, we've seen hurricanes before, but never a direct hit to New Orleans. And this is the time when they need us most. And we need to be here in Iraq. Our presence is very much needed. We're helping these people. It can't be two places at one time.
No, you certainly can't. Well, Sergeant Laney Poche, in Baghdad, before we let you go, any message to your friends, your family, your colleagues in Louisiana that you'd like us to pass along with this interview?
I'd just like to say hello, and I'll be home on the 23rd of this month, so I'll see them real soon.
You'll be home the 27th of this month. Well, thank you so much for joining us here on Mother Jones Radio from Baghdad, Sergeant Poche.
Thank you very much. Bye.
You can only imagine the abject frustration for soldiers such as Sergeant Poche sitting there in Iraq, despite the fact that she supports the mission, looking at the television and seeing that devastation, and hearing her commanders, such as Lieutenant Colonel Pete Schneider of the Louisiana National Guard, who said, and this is his quote, "The National Guard needs that equipment back home to support the Homeland Security mission." And Sergeant Poche telling us that she's going home. She wants to help, but the equipment is going to stay in Iraq, that Louisiana equipment.
She's a patriot. My heart goes out to her and her unit. This is clearly a reflection of the priorities of the President of the United States. We've got a catastrophe that was not only predictable, it was predicted.
It was absolutely predicted by politicians on the left, on the right, and by the experts at the Corps of Engineers, at the universities, and the money that was demanded by those who said they knew how to protect New Orleans was removed from the budget by the White House.
It was predicted and then ignored by the President of the United States.
And then ignored for a couple of days more until he finally got around to having Air Force One slow down on his way back to Washington.
Don't want to interrupt that vacation.
It's an unbelievable situation that one would think, Jay, just from a political standpoint, the administration would be clever enough to handle otherwise.
Well, we've been here before, though, with this lack of response to genuine human crises.
It's Mother Jones Radio. I'm Peter Laufer with Mother Jones publisher, Jay Harris.
Mother Jones Radio, the best in independent investigative reporting, obligated only to you.
In for Angie Coiro, I'm Peter Laufer here with Mother Jones publisher Jay Harris. Now, Jay, when the president finally got back to Washington, he acted really surprised on the program Good Morning America.
I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
In fact, the breach of the levees were anticipated by many people.
In fact, in June of 2002, there was a five-part series in the New Orleans Times-Picayune, written by John McQuaid and Mark Schleifstein, that spelled out in great detail the likelihood that New Orleans would be flooded by even a relatively mild hurricane if it breached the levees.
I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
And in the National Geographic, well before the storm, was a typical National Geographic scenario painted in an article that read in part, "Big Easy was buried under a blanket of putrid sediment. 1 million people were homeless and 50,000 were dead. It was the worst natural disaster in the history of the United States." When did this calamity happen, the article asks? It hasn't yet, but the doomsday scenario is not far-fetched. The Federal Emergency Management Agency lists, according to the National Geographic, well before the hurricane, a hurricane strike on New Orleans as one of the most dire threats to the nation.
I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
But that's not all. Jay, we've got a stack of papers on this desk. What's the next one?
Of course, in addition to the Times-Picayune and National Geographic, the National Public Radio aired a two-part series in September of 2002 by Daniel Zwirling that did a similar analysis. Just a couple days ago, David Folkenflik of the National NPR.org website said how haunting it must be for a news organization to fulfill its core function by sounding the alarm as the public's watchdog and then go unheeded.
I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
But it's not just the Times-Picayune, National Geographic, and NPR. In The Prospect, earlier this year in May, Chris Mooney wrote about exactly this type of storm, saying such a storm plowing over the lake could generate a 20-foot surge that would easily overwhelm the levees of New Orleans, which only protect against a hybrid Category 2 or Category 3 storm. Soon the geographical bowl of the Crescent City would fill up with the waters of the lake, leaving those unable to evacuate with little option but to cluster on rooftops, terrain they would have to share with hungry rats, fire ants, snakes, and perhaps alligators.
I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
But that's not all. One more, Jay, from that pile.
Add to that list the thousands of scientists around the globe who have been studying global warming and its effects and have predicted dramatically an increase in catastrophic weather events. Recently, Ross Gelbspan, a contributor to Mother Jones, wrote in the Boston Globe that the hurricane that struck Louisiana was nicknamed Katrina by the National Weather Service. Its real name is global warming.
I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
You're listening to Mother Jones Radio. So, Jay, the president said no one could forecast the breaching of the levees, but obviously we know that that's erroneous. What certainly can be forecast now is that we have a homeless crisis following the hurricane crisis.
Certainly. I mean, the geography that was encompassed by this storm really is not only the reasonably rich town of New Orleans, but of course they're working class, and then all along the Gulf Coast.
And
there,
as you go on the Gulf Coast from New Orleans in the direction of Florida, it's spotted with cities, substantial cities like Biloxi, but also villages, small towns. That's well populated. That's not wild space.
Right, and most of these towns who are on the coast have, of course, been smashed and wiped out.
Devastated. And then once you get to Florida, you get to the scene of where there have been hurricanes in recent years, not as devastating as Katrina, but certainly horrific. And working with the homeless from those hurricanes is Ginger Ferguson in Brevard County at the Coalition for the Hungry and Homeless at Brevard County in Florida. It's good to have you with us, Ginger. Florida was assaulted with these hurricanes. Are all those homeless from last year taken care of and happy in split levels in the suburbs?
I wish. That would be wonderful if that were a fact. But unfortunately, we still have a housing crisis here. We still have probably 600 or more families and elderly that are living in FEMA trailers here. We still have a tremendous lack of affordable housing. The housing that was damaged or destroyed has mostly been replaced or rehabbed. But after that, the prices have gone up considerably, leaving many of our poor and those that are at imminent risk of homelessness now currently homeless on the street.
And those who are in those FEMA trailers, what's that lifestyle about?
It's not a good situation. We have families with 3 and 4 children living in 1 and 2 bedroom mobile homes. Some of the mobile homes are deteriorated. It's become a crisis situation for almost everyone living in FEMA trailers.
Let's shift to the site of the current catastrophe. There are orders of magnitude more people displaced by Hurricane Katrina. What are all these people going to do?
It's just catastrophic. I don't know. And there's just no quick or easy answer to this crisis situation. There are just going to be thousands and thousands of people with nowhere to go.
What's the prospect of having, even over an extended period of time, government rebuild affordable housing for the working class families that have been now made homeless?
Oh, you're looking at years and years and years of construction and reconstruction. In the meantime, I don't know what the answer is going to be, but somehow our government's going to have to step up to the plate and provide some safe, decent housing for people in this situation.
And on a realistic level, Ginger, as we look forward just days and weeks, give us an example of how these people are going to live.
I thank God for the Red Cross, the Salvation Armies, all the charitable groups that are going to be able to provide some assistance, some food, some water, and maybe some shelter spaces. But you can only stay in a shelter so long, and there's got to be alternative housing options available for these people.
In the crisis in Florida last fall, what were the options for these people over the extended time?
Well, we didn't have a whole lot. Our shelters closed down relatively quickly after the hurricanes hit. We had every motel room, every possible option was full. We had families that had to leave the area to go to another area to stay with family because there was no housing. We had nothing available, no rentals, nothing available for anyone, and it was a big crisis here trying to find placement for people, even people who had the means to afford to rent a property. There were no properties available.
Ginger Ferguson, what were you thinking when the president said no one could forecast this this crisis? Of course, hurricanes of this magnitude have been forecast, and the Corps of Engineers, among others, said that these levees needed attention.
Well, no one can forecast a hurricane of that magnitude, but there is some time available to prepare and to evacuate when we know that a hurricane is coming. Unfortunately, most of the people that are suffering now are those that did not have the means to evacuate. They had no transportation or they didn't have the money, and they couldn't go like we could during our evacuation and spend a week in a motel room.
Ginger Ferguson, at the Coalition for the Hungry and Homeless at Brevard County in Florida. Thanks for joining us on Mother Jones Radio.
Thank you so much.
Of course, before Katrina, there was Cindy giving the president a headache. Earlier this week, reporter Maury Meniscus of Week Time magazine traveled to Crawford, Texas, to interview the president before he cut his five-week vacation, 2 days short, to finally survey Katrina's devastation.
And now, the minute America turns to Maury's Minute, featuring award-winning investigative journalist Maury Meniscus. That's me. Dateline, Crawford, Texas. Summertime and the living is easy, especially if you're a certain commander-in-chief with a month of vacation time. This week, your man Maury has hopped the scoop jet down south for an exclusive head-to-head with our head of state. We'll clear some brush and hopefully clear some things up about the protesters at Camp Casey. Welcome to the Minute, Mr. President.
Welcome to Crawford. Good to see you. Let me get that.
Thanks. Sir, I want you to know I've sworn to uphold the journalist's code.
Are you talking about the filter? I wouldn't know anything about that.
Well, the code dictates that I interview you politely and impartially, but with a bloodhound's nose for news. The kid gloves are off.
I see.
However, I wouldn't want any of my questions to make you uncomfortable to the point of, say, barring me from the White House press pool. So if we veer into that territory, simply reply, too personal.
Too personal. Maury, tell you what, you bring it on.
Sir, recent polls show your approval rating at an all-time low.
I appreciate that question. My response, the presidency is hard work.
What I mean is, given the polls, is it wise to take such a long vacation?
Timetable's not important. I'll stay here in Crawford as long as it takes, and not a day more.
But some say, with troops on extended tours, it's improper for you...
I don't think it's proper to knock the guard. It's wrong.
No, of course. I'm sorry.
You know what? I ain't giving you a nickname yet. I could get you a nickname.
Nickname?
Everybody in the press corps got a nickname. I'm going to call you Weenus.
Weenus?
Yeah, Weenus. I like that. Weenus.
Okay. Next topic, Cindy Sheehan.
Never heard of her.
Been protesting all month. She's right over there.
Oh, her.
Why won't you meet with her?
Too personal.
Good enough for me.
Your minute's up, Weenus. Have a good day.
This has been Maury's Minute, where we've been doing some summer grilling. Grilling the president, that is. Hope I wasn't too hard on him, but it's my job to dig for answers. I'm looking out for you, America. When you want the real story, turn to Maury. That's me.
Maury's Minute is a creation of Ward and Mark Sutton.
And coming up here on Mother Jones Radio, Jay and I will be speaking with Harvey Kay. He's the author of the new book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Mother Jones Radio, following in the tradition of Mother Jones Magazine.
30 years of hell-raising investigative reporting in print, online, and now on the air.
Want to know more? Come visit us at motherjones.com. At that website, you also can take advantage of a special radio offer for a subscription to Mother Jones Magazine. This is Mother Jones Radio.
Mother Jones Radio is brought to you in part by the Gruber Family Foundation and Janet A. Boyle.
They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.
Mother Jones Radio. Asks what others don't, says what others won't.
In for Angie Coiro, I'm Peter Laufer here with Mother Jones publisher Jay Harris, and we're going to take a breather for a few minutes from the hurricane coverage and talk about the Founding Fathers, or at least one of them. Thomas Paine and the Promise of America is the title of a book by Harvey Kay, published by Heal & Wang. And Harvey Kay is on the line with us from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Harvey, hi, this is Jay. Why a Tom Paine book now?
Why a Tom Paine book now? Actually, before I even talk directly about that, I can tell you that there are a lot of books coming out on Tom Paine. And I think it has to do with the fact that Americans are rather anxious about the state of affairs, not only inside the country but outside the country, that we're concerned about our place in the world. We're concerned about the very meaning and promise, or purpose and promise, of America. And naturally, when we get anxious like that, we look back. We look back to figures such as the Founding Fathers, as well as figures like Lincoln and others. And we look back, not necessarily expecting them to tell us exactly what to do, but for various reasons, for inspiration, for encouragement, and maybe even for ideas for us to test in the present. Now, why Paine in particular amongst the founders? Well, arguably Paine was the one who never exploited humanity, never owned slaves. But even more than that, Paine was the one who spoke to us at the very beginning, at the very founding of the nation. And he was the one who not only spoke of independence, he spoke of making America into a democratic republic. And when we look back to Paine, I think not only do we rediscover the very meaning of America, I think we find ourselves there quite often. Because I think that in the course of these 200 and more years, we have, in essence, carried forward Paine's memory and legacy such that today, in 2005, we feel that, even if we don't always know that.
Is what we have now what Paine had in mind?
Well, in part, yeah, in part. I mean, consider the fact we no longer have slavery. We have universal suffrage. We have labor unions representing working people. We have many of the things that Paine would have envisioned. But we also have many of the things Paine would be rather horrified by. I mean, for example, we have a situation in which inequality is growing constantly. We have a situation in which it seems separation of church and state is under threat by the current Republican administration. We have a situation in which the United States finds itself at war overseas, not part of a global alliance that he would have expected to extend freedom, equality, and democracy. You know, it's not the vision he had of America that currently prevails in our, at least in governmental quarters.
Harvey Kay, author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, in your book you remind us so clearly that back in 1776 we were divided, as we are now. Is that maybe our nature?
I don't think there's any question it's in Americans' nature to be cantankerous and rambunctious. If anything, we may actually be rather quiet right now. Divided, yes, but I think Paine would be surprised at how quiet things are. He would find it hard to believe that a party calling itself the Democrats fails to be unified in support of extending freedom, equality, and democracy in America. He would be surprised at the way in which so many of us stand by wondering what to do. I mean, he would appreciate the anxiety, but he would wonder where that rebellious instinct that he saw in Americans, where it went to.
Yeah, but then he would turn on the radio on his way to work and he would hear talk radio. What would his response be to that? That's not quiet. Is it just superficial?
No, it doesn't matter? He would hear talk radio and he would, you know, in one sense he'd be rather excited. He'd hear that kind of noise. On the other hand, he wouldn't help but ask. I mean, although he was never a socialist, he would never have argued for the redistribution of property. He would be terribly upset to find out that there's a corporate aristocracy that dominates the airwaves, that limits, if you like, that exercise of free speech, not to the extent we know of making things illegal, but controlling it through the corporate purse.
One of the things I found fascinating about your book was as you reprised Paine's legacy in America, you juxtaposed it with the forces that really opposed some of Paine's ideas, and in part the 19th century equivalent of today's religious right. Can you talk a little bit about that, and are there parallels really to today?
Well, if I could just note the sort of historical dimension, it's interesting that today left and right both lay claim to Paine's memory and legacy. But we should remember that for 200 years, conservatives, the property, the powerful, the prestigious, the pious, all the P's we can think of, made every effort to suppress his memory. In fact, there were many historians and most biographers who believed that he had been forgotten in American life, so that he would have been called the lost founder or the forgotten founder. And yet, what I found, against everything I expected to find, and in fact the contract for my book originally was meant to be the story of the suppression of his memory, what I found is that in every generation, Americans look back and laid claim to Paine to, in their own times, extend and advance freedom, equality, and democracy, so that free thinkers and abolitionists and women's movements, beginning with the suffrage folk, working men's advocates, labor organizers, socialists, populists, progressives, all the way through in every generation, there were these movements that laid claim to Paine, and in essence laid claim to America's revolutionary tradition to carry it forward. At the very same time, we find that in the what we would call official memory, in the public official occasions, the statesmen, the corporate leaders, the most powerful cultural figures would ignore Paine, or if they referred to him at all, they generally referred to him in a rather derogatory way. So,
Harvey Kay, what is the lesson of Paine for the contemporary times of the moment? For example, the federal government response to the hurricane.
Oh, boy, now that's a question. Well, Paine always emphasized the notion of the commonwealth and the public good. And what I've been picking up, and I lived in Louisiana for a few years, and what I've been picking up is that we have to come to grips with the fact that we've got a rather perverted sense of the commonwealth, and we have a decidedly inegalitarian kind of social order. I mean, it's hard to imagine a president taking so long to respond to that kind of tragedy, that kind of disaster. And yet one can't help but imagine that they've so weakened the capacity of government to respond to these things by way of cutting taxes, by way of sending, you know, National Guardsmen overseas. And in essence, Paine would be rather horrified at the neglect of the commonwealth and the public good. Does that get at what you're getting?
Absolutely. And more of that in your book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, what you're calling a letter to the left. Harvey Kay, thanks so much for joining us here today on Mother Jones Radio.
Thank you.
I'm Peter Lauffer with Jay Harris. Check out the Mother Jones website to learn more about the magazine and to get a chance to listen to archived Mother Jones radio shows. We'll see you next week.